Tonight on Arena, Frank McGuinness on his new poetry collection, The River Cranna, and Savage Indignation, a musical retelling of the story of Jonathan Swift, Stella and Vanessa. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena, and you can watch us on rte.ie/arena. Frank McGuinness is without doubt one of our greatest writers, best known perhaps for plays such as The Factory Girls, Observe the Sons of Ulster Marching Towards the Somme, Carthaginians, and Someone Who'll Watch Over Me, as well as his adaptations of Ibsen. But he has also written novels, songs, operas and poetry. In fact, it was with poetry that he started out, sending some of his poems to the late David Marcus at the Irish Press. "You are a writer," he was told, and off he went. And it was poetry that he was writing during lockdown, and we're now blessed with a new collection of his called The River Cranna, published by the Gallery Press, and absolutely delighted that Frank McGuinness is sitting across the desk from me.
Thank you, Sean.
In studio this evening. It was poetry, and I've heard you talk about that moment when David Marcus, I mean, he was such a vital force in
absolutely.
Terms of mid-20th century Irish writing. You are a writer. When you saw that, this young fellow from Buncrana, when you saw that, what did it mean?
Oh, it was a wonderful recognition as well as encouragement. And David used to type these letters on, I think it was a sort of a light green paper. And he would give you a detailed response to the poems you sent him, which nobody had ever done before for me. So I was getting my first taste of, you know, what a genuine critical voice could do to your work. But I was like about 20, I think, actually. And they even paid, the Irish Press even paid, believe it or not. And at that time, living on the clippings of 10 of a grant, that was nearly like a week's food money as well as everything else. He was a joy to be with. His company was terrific. He carried his learning extremely lightly. He shared it. He was an exceptionally generous man. And his acknowledgement of me as a writer meant so much, absolutely so much.
Well, it's given you, I don't know how many decades of writing at this stage across so many different genres, as they say, poetry, opera, plays, novels. It's all there. But in Buncrana, growing up in Buncrana, because you're saying that happened around about 20, around about the age of 20, you were at college at that stage.
I was in UCD,
you were in UCD at that point in time. Growing up in Buncrana, in that house of women, which you did grow up in, were there little scribblings going on up in the room?
Oh, yeah, I had a complete fantasy world. Emily Bronte and the Claude, you know. But I did have a fantasy world of strange codes and symbols that only I could penetrate and never would reveal the key or the secret to. They basically were my secret voice to myself and that I could write anything I wanted to. We weren't a house with books. We just didn't have books, but we had magazines, we had papers. And there was a local library, which I was a member of, a lovely woman called Julia Kavanagh. She ran it and was very welcoming and very warm. But, I now am a house inundated with books, but not then. No, and it took me a while to really get into the habit of it. I've no great memories of children's literature and things like that.
Although one of the first books I think that you read as a teenager was Pride and Prejudice.
It was, yes, Pride and Prejudice. People don't believe me, but it was Pride and Prejudice and The Ship of Adventure by Enid Blyton.
So, the two together.
More or less, actually. They were the two books in the house. I adore Jane Austen, a worshipper, a reverer. And Enid Blyton's not too bad either, actually. But that was the scale of our home library. We had a Bible as well.
We had a home Bible. The Bible to be flitting through as well for the verse.
Very much, yeah.
But just sticking with the Jane Austen for a moment, if I can, what was it about what she was saying, particularly, or the way she was writing in that book? Did it speak to you in a particular way?
I think it did, actually, because I think it was her precision. I mean, you could tell from reading her, even as a young fella, that here was a woman who was absolutely in command of her material. And not merely was she in command of her material, she could make you aware that there were levels of perception and levels of humour. and levels of analysis and levels of feeling that she was sharing with you. She's one of the most generous of writers, and of course one of the most deceptive. And that that combination of truth and secrets was, you know, even more strong than Secrets and Lies.
Yeah, well, there you go. Truth and Secrets. We're back to that. That the fact that you were writing your poems or whatever you were writing, even if it was stories, it was all in a secret language that,
very much
that,
so,
that only
yeah.
you could understand.
Yes.
Where would you have been made fun of?
I don't know, actually. I think it was just taken to be an oddball. Mm. And I was always that. So I think that it would have added to the fun rather than just make, you know, started the fun. I certainly wouldn't want them to know what I was actually up to. I wouldn't want anybody to know. Not that there's any badness in it or you
yeah.
know, dirty stuff in it or anything else. It was just like my private world and nobody had access to it and I wasn't going to give it to them. I just wanted to have it myself.
Well, that's it. Because as a writer, of course, you have to share your private world, but maybe you do it in a coded type of way that it's something different for you than it is for the reader or the watcher of your plays.
Absolutely, and it wasn't. I mean, it really wasn't. It was just a code. It was a world that I had access to. It was not poetry. It was not fiction. It was not theatre. It started with lyrics, actually, with music, lyrics for songs, but I couldn't play an instrument. But that was the first thing that I was actually sharing that people could have deciphered. I don't think any of them exist anymore. The copybooks probably would die if I saw them, actually. But, I mean, I was into, you know, Joni Mitchell and the Beatles, the Stones, and they were big heroes of mine.
And as much for the lyrics as you were?
Mostly for the lyrics, actually. And Joni is, of course, a great lyricist.
Yeah.
And Paul McCartney and Lennon.
But there were, as I say, this family of women around you, particularly your grandmother, who features in the collection around a doctor.
Yes.
You might tell the story. My Grandmother's Heart, I think, is the title of the poem.
My Grandmother's Heart. My grandmother was this wonderful, small woman called Lizzie O'Donnell. And she was O'Donnell before she was married. She was O'Donnell after she was married. And she was O'Donnell through and through. O'Donnell Abu was written for her, I think. But she had jet black hair. And she had, I think she had 10 children, 8 of whom lived. And every one of them had red hair, apart from one who died, who had black hair. He died when he was 12, Liam. And she was a woman who you didn't cross. Her motto was, if you want to know something, ask. And she was fearless in the asking. You know?
She took on the church. Now, we're talking about the 1930s. Let's just remember how she took on the local parish priest, I presume it was. She took on the clergy at a time when doing so, you know, would have caused serious problems for somebody.
But she was a very devout Catholic.
Yeah, within that as well.
But she was a very devout Catholic. But she was a woman who inspired in her daughters as well a sense that injustice has to be confronted. And if it's not fair, it should be told. And she feared nobody. She really did fear nobody, actually. She was a tremendous warrior.
And she stood up for, was it a young woman who had a child?
Well, she was kind.
Yeah.
She was very kind.
Very kind to people. Let us read a poem that will bring us right back to what sounds like an idyllic Christmas Eve.
In Buncrana.
If you have the page, it's page 96 if you're searching for it there in the collection, Frank. This is Frank McGuinness about to read from his book, The River Crana, the poem which is simply called Buncrana Christmas Eve.
Well, Hallow Eve, New Year's Eve is especially powerful in Buncrana because the Scottish immigrants all came back for it. And I always loved Christmas Eve. It was a special day in the town. And this is a poem remembering those days. After the fasting, we supped on salmon, tinned, sent by cousins from Canada. We wait for camels and the three magi. A glut of myrrh suffused Buncrana, white with a haze of frankincense, the terrible smell of Casey's drapers, the souvenir house's bracelet gold charms, McVeigh's chemist, yellow ribbon soap, a chip shop belonged to Maggie Rowe, and the Centra's black Italian coffee scented the Donegal December tempest. Their Mediterranean mother, ancient as Apulia, whispers Irish rain. Ireland, most beautiful in all the world, but rain, this country, cold, cold rain. Yet in our scullery, a steam of soup, velvet barley and orange lentils, heats the moon and stars of leeks, warming the astrolabe world by hand, fixing the orbits of sisters, brothers, colliding with kin and gentle neighbours, feeding on what is everlasting, receiving what was ours to receive, streets wrapped in the green hereafter, Buncrana, alive, at peace, Christmas Eve.
Buncrana, Christmas Eve, read there by Frank McGuinness from his new collection, The River Crana. And there really is such a sense of, you know, an easeful and a happy young man. Is that a memory, I presume, looking back on
that
time?
I think it is a memory, actually, and it's always anticipation. It's why it's the eve, not the day, yeah. Which is a bit of a giveaway, actually. Christmas Day was different. Different Christmas Day. Every family has its own fraught stories of Christmas Day. We were no exception.
But the nature of that family then, you mean, was it a raucous household? Was it a place where debate, when you describe your grandmother and your mother had a similar kind of steely determination that injustice could not be observed and ignored. Was it a raucous, you know?
It was happy,
both households.
Actually. It was happy, it was loud. There were a lot of people. And silence was not particularly valued or welcome. Usually my mother thought they were up to something. It was too quiet. But it was a happy time in that, you know, we didn't have much money, but what we had we spent and we shared.
And you revisit, the entire collection isn't about Buncrana. I mean, it goes across a whole raft of materials. There's lots of Renaissance and Italian painters in there. Emily Dickinson gets an outing. Sylvia Plath is mentioned along the way. And you mention also the Japanese art of kintsugi. And I just wondered, let's hear that. Will you read the poem for me, first of all, and we talk a little bit about it afterwards and what it means to you?
It's page
54.
The vase knew its place. It took its time to fall. It slipped from my hands, scattering the daffodils, water like white ink, haunting every empty pages. In Japan, they hope what smashed can be mended, healed, not as new, never as new, but still on show, displaying its blemish. What beauty lies in blemish? They call it kintsugi, a thread of gold, a torn obi, a web of sisters, a nest of brothers.
Frank McGuinness reading his poem Kintsugi from his new collection, The River Crana. And that line, what beauty lies in blemish. I wondered how that thought, because that poem really stands out for me within the collection. It's almost a little island on its very own. But that idea of blemish or pain, you know, it's Cohen that talks about it's the cracks that let the light in. How has that informed not just your poetry, but how you have written throughout your life?
Well, one of the great joys of my working life was working with Maureen Toll, the great actress.
Ah.
And Maureen and I did a play called Bag Lady together. And there's a line in Bag Lady where the character says, you know, what's torn can't be put back together again. You can try, but what's the use? And Maureen did that with such power and density and honesty that I've never forgot it. And I knew it was her favourite line in the entire play. So it has haunted practically everything I've ever written since then. And this poem, really, I can see its origins in that utterance that Maureen made and then that observation she made. You know, I think that it's true to say of Maureen as well. She knew whereof she spoke when she was speaking of severance and of sorrow. And I think that, you know, in that strange Japanese art of transforming what seems to be beyond repair, but is actually mended in ways that you could never anticipate it. That to me is one of the essences of creativity. So that's what it comes from.
And to what extent, you know, I can see probably in an easier fashion when you're writing a play and when you're writing a character, you're looking for that blemish in the character. That's what makes the character interesting, that blemish or those several blemishes, if there are many of them. There is, Is the writing of the play in that respect looking for that? Is it very different from when you're writing a poem, which is much more a short lyric?
Oh, the poem is much more revealing of yourself. I find that anyway, actually. But the great thing about having written so many plays is that you can disguise yourself in as many characters as you want, you know. But I certainly would tackle subjects in play in poems that I wouldn't go near in plays, because it would take too much out of myself and be too revealing of people that I love. Whereas in poetry, I think you can find a voice, you can find a vision, you can find a way forward, that really it's possible to go ahead with some degree of objectivity.
Maybe with that in mind, would you read Benfica for me, which is
yes.
which is despite the name, the title, it is very much a Buncrana poem. This is on page 81.
Now, there were two big housing estates in Buncrana when I was growing up. One was Marion Park, and our enemies were Castle Park. And I should point out that I was not a sportsman, but I had pals who would play for Castle Park and others who'd play for Marion Park. So the rivalry was intense. There was a guy at school with me, a really good man called John Fullerton, who was a fantastic football player. And I think he was captain of this team that Castle Park had, which they called Benfica. I think it must have been the Portuguese influence in Castle Park. Anyway, I'll read it for you, Benfica. Castle Park called their team Benfica. A fair, fit side, they played a decent game on a rough pitch overlooking the Crana. Sundays, they crossed the bridge to Cow Park and take on boys from Cluanwara. Not that I ever troubled any match, watching from our back window, listening to language I never learned to master. At our wall, serving tennis aces, I was Wimbledon, Paris, New York and Melbourne, the greatest Grand Slam my name attached. No one else ever sported bat and ball, so that became the nickname given me. Chanted until the craven coward always, I would do a runner from the garden. They owned the world, me not the full shilling, sentenced to admire the work of giants, bathing in the blood of illusions shattered, in body, in soul, supporting for life, Castle Park, Cluanwara, Benfica.
Benfica, from Frank McGuinness's new collection, The River Crana. What struck me about that, Frank, is that there is the real sense that even at that point you were an outsider within this, not within your family. I mean, you were very much at home within the family.
Very protected.
Yeah, you get the sense of a very loved young boy and young man. Did you have a sense that somehow that artistic calling or whatever it was that did single you out in a way, that did it make it difficult?
I was pretty much aware from an early age of my sexuality that I was gay. Mm. And that certainly gave me a fear and a weird way of confidence to be as different as I wanted to be. And that I kind of learned to not trust the group because I knew they could turn. I always knew the value you could put on, you know, asserting your own self. No, I couldn't always do it, and I certainly wasn't brave. Craven Coward, I come to, and I was a battle, as they say, in Donegal. But I still had an inkling that life was not going to be a bed of roses. That being a man who loved men was going to be something that I would have to confront and carry, and that was the case.
But then the bravery to because you weren't a craven coward when you came to college and when you got involved in theatre here and in the plays you wrote. There was no cowardice in any of that, and that many of them were very revealing of lots of aspects of your personality. Where did that bravery come from?
I think it was just a determination that I was going to do as well as I possibly could in the form of literature that I was working on. And if I was also not going to tell lies. I was really going to try not to tell lies anyway. And that came from the courage of the characters in my background, like my grandmother and my grandfather and uncles and aunts and parents. And I said, you know, I didn't see the sense of lying about who you are. Even as a young fella, I didn't see the sense of that. It always struck me as ridiculous. And, you know, you pay the price consequently for that. But it's a good price to pay.
The title poem of the new collection, I was kind of surprised when I read through this. It's quite a long poem. I just quote a couple of lines from it. Tell me what you can of the River Crannagh. No, it will not speak about itself. And further on, I will ask again the River Crannagh to explain itself in caw or cadence. And I'm skipping down to the end of the stanza. I first heard it calling, singing, I am not yours, nor will I ever be. Ask all you like.
Yeah. I mean, it's confrontational. It's where I'm from. It's what we're like. We are difficult, you know, and we don't palm each other off with easy answers. So I love the Crannagh because it's not mine. It's a self. It flows through what is called Swan Park. A wonderful man called Harry Swan brought electricity to the town. He ran the mill and he left this wonderful gift to Buncrana that the council has really tried, and I have to acknowledge them for doing that, to turn into this beautiful park with the river going through it. And that's only in recent years that we really appreciate this gorgeous river. But it's not mine, it's nobody's, it's its own. And, you know, I wouldn't take it on, you know.
Yeah, so you got a poem out of it not telling you what
exactly.
It was.
Exactly. I mean, this is why I remember my dear friend Owen McCafferty said about writing novels, well, he couldn't be bothered because of too much scenery. And I was never one for the scenery, you know. Right. And that's why I wanted to write about a landscape that was stand up for itself and say, you're not going to get me down.
Yeah, you're not writing about me.
You know, I'm off. Yeah. And I like that about it, yeah.
Yeah. And there are some lovely poems here. Gus Martin gets a lovely mention. Lovely, lovely dedication to Eileen Battersby. And,
great,
of course, the collection dedicated to both of them.
Tom Kilroy and Gerard Daw,
who died in recent times.
Yeah, well, Tom was a very powerful influence on my life, actually. He was a great mentor to me when I was starting writing. Mm. Gerard was a dear friend. I taught Eileen in her first year in UCD.
And that's what the poem treats, in fact.
Gus was, again, a great benevolent presence in my life. He was my tutor in first year in UCD as well. So they all came knocking at the door, asking to be remembered. And I took great delight in remembering them.
I want to finish with what might have been. So...
Dear God.
Driving a lorry. Uh-huh. If you hadn't started to scribble in your little codes in your bedroom in Buncrana, if you hadn't got out and gone down to college, this might have been the case.
Well, the sad truth is that my father could drive a lorry or any other vehicle from the age of about 7. My grandfather had a fleet of, you know, not crapped out old jalopies that they all learnt on. And the sad truth is that none of us, my brother, my sister, myself, can drive. And once when asked, would you teach me to drive, Dad? He said, have you seen the way you walk? And I said, no. But anyway, this is learning to drive. It's for my dear cousin Paula.
On page 103, driving a lorry.
No.
Have we given you a bum steer on the page number?
Yeah, get it on.
Oh, sorry, it's page 105. Beg your pardon.
105. I might yet learn to drive a lorry. My father and his brothers could, before they were 12. Careful, guaranteed to get the beast home. Not one scratch, not a dent on the bodywork. Sweet Afton in their lips, sober at the wheel. Able to master what needs mastering, they poured the lorry where petrol took it, finding in their pocket the keys to ignite.
Frank McGuinness with his poem, Driving a Lorry, from the new collection, The River Crannagh, which is published by Gallery Press. Frank, thanks so much for coming
in. Thank you,
Sean,
as always. A pleasure.
And hope to see you again very soon.
Thank you.
If you happen to be visiting Dublin's historic quarter around Kilmainham, a trip to IMA, the Irish Museum of Modern Art, can be a very relaxing and stimulating experience. By the way, you don't even have to go inside at the moment, as the living canvas on IMA's front lawn offers you the chance to sit on a deck chair and watch the 2020 work from Maya Nunez Arima, performance art film made in response to a love letter between choreographer Merce Cunningham and composer John Cage. But you might want to venture inside into the galleries and let my next guest, Jess Fahey, be your guide if you do decide to do that. Jess, you have been to see Artist Agency at IMA, work from the permanent collection, and as well as going to bring us through the exhibition this evening, you are giving guided tours of that selfsame exhibition. Art and Agency, it really is dealing with the permanent collection of IMA, which is quite the permanent collection.
It is an extraordinary collection. And the fact that there is such a, I suppose, concept with IMA in general that they want to have up-to-date contemporary arts, you know, most modern, most avant-garde. But the permanent collection is so important too, particularly in learning about Irish art. And
it can't be on display all the time.
No, it's huge. It's about 3,000, 3,500 works. They just couldn't possibly. But when it is on display like this, and particularly the way it's curated currently, is that it's such a fun experience. Now, it's challenging too, but you start to realise just how many exciting Irish artists there have been, where they fit in the broader stories of international art, and just how diverse it all is.
And I guess this all started with Gordon Lambert and 300. He said, I'll give you 300 paintings.
Yeah.
If you create a space that will be a museum of modern art.
Yeah, so he said it to Charles Haughey, and he said that this was basically kind of a need for Ireland, and it was. Because as much as the Hugh Lane was started as a modern art gallery, it wasn't, I suppose, in many ways at that point kind of going for the most contemporary. Now it is a lot more like that today, but there was still so much more space in the Irish art world and institutions and art market to have a lot more going on. And particularly, I think, because generally within, you know, elements of Irish art, it had been quite conservative. Yeah. It had been quite insular, quite rural, all of those things that we needed somewhere that was going to have that sort of brave, bold attitude and show the weirdest and strangest and controversial and, you know, challenging things.
And not, not all of them are international works, and not all of them are Irish-based works either.
Yes.
But we're going to start with an Irish-based work, Northern artist Colin Middleton, Bon Voyage. We can show you these, by the way, on at RTE Arena. I had to look at this about three times. Where is it even hanging?
It's the
so
perfect
explain the
choice.
Work, first of all, and explain how you see it within this exhibition.
So it's the perfect choice because in the painting, it's like this sort of doll-like woman who's being kind of held almost by strings or her hair on a balloon in this, you know, expansive sky. So it's very surrealist, very fairy tale kind of illustration.
Yeah, and that's within a frame. But it's easy to paint something in midair. But to make the painting itself then framed look as if it's hanging in midair.
So this is part of the exhibition choice. So it actually comes from an Italian architect, Lina Bobardi, who was involved in designing both the building and the display decisions in MASP in Sao Paulo in Brazil. And these works are kind of like floating easels is the best way of thinking about them. So there's a block of concrete with then glass coming up to hold the painting in. So that's why it sort of looks like it's floating.
Yeah.
But the Middleton work works perfectly for it because it's a scene of floating. But the other reason that she did it, Bobardi, in the original version, was that she wanted you to be able to see multiple images at once if you move just slightly within the space.
You see something on one of the other walls.
So you see what's behind.
In the gallery,
and then also when you walk behind them, then you get to get a little bit more of the material history of the object itself because you can see the back of the frame, the stickers, the stamps, those things that, although, you know, seem, you know, maybe not as interesting, hopefully not as interesting, they are still interesting. And for me, even looking at the backs of them, I was kind of laughing at, you know, how you could see who sold them, who reframed them.
Yeah, so it tells the history of the film, of the piece of work.
It's another art history. It's a different type of art history, but it is still an art history. So there's just one section of the exhibition that has a long series with, you know,
of these floating, almost floating.
So there's a Jack B. Yates, there's a Kathy Prendergast and a few others.
And something like the fact that the Jack B. Yates is in there. I suppose they're laying out the stall here. You're in a modernist place. This exhibition is going to be dealing with contemporary work.
Yes, I always think that, you know, Jack B. Yates is kind of the gateway in, you know, because people aren't as afraid necessarily of him. He's more familiar. But weirdly, with him in that context, particularly because where he is or his work is in one of these floating easels, To the right is Patricia Hurl. And she was sort of, you know, pushed aside as maybe being a little bit difficult as an artist. When you see her right next to Jack B. Yeats, stylistically, they're not that different.
And a very big retrospective of Patricia Hurl recently. And in fact, we spoke with her. What are we seeing of hers in this particular exhibition?
So there's two by her. There's one called Flight, which is the one just right beside the Jack B. Yeats Closing Time, Stephen's Green one. And that's sort of relates, or at least we're told that it relates to her, the end of her marriage. But it's not so much about telling you a subject, it's about telling you a mood, an emotion. It's very dark, it's very intimidating. It feels kind of eerie and unsettling. And then there's another one that has a little bit more of a figurative element of a woman lied out with a kind of cut open stomach that relates to her own loss of a child. And then it's called Jingle Bells, with a kind of singing choir in the background. So she's a very fascinating and dark artist. But her work was often sort of sidelined because there was a lot of prejudice against women artists. Yeah. They just weren't taken seriously.
And she fought hard to just to establish herself as an artist, quite simply.
She almost didn't really. That retrospective you're talking about was one of the first times that some of those paintings were seen. And when Emma went to her stores, they couldn't believe the works that were there. And they kind of, you know, took out painting after painting. Yeah, so it's great to see her right back in the story.
And in
Irish
the
art.
Midst of this contemporary, this retro, I suppose, in some ways, looking back at 60 years.
Exactly.
Or more than 60 years, it looks a bit of
the last up to now. Yeah.
However, nothing in any of those paintings would have prepared me for a briquette sandwich with butter in the middle.
I know, it's fantastic, isn't it?
So two briquettes and a big chunk of butter in the middle.
It's so Irish, and that's the thing that's so fabulous about it. Not by an Irish artist, though. Mm. By an extraordinary, very provocative activist artist, Joseph Boyes, who came to Ireland with kind of an idea of almost sort of setting up some sort of modern art school or contemporary art school. But really, he was interested in myth and legend. Yeah. Having created one about his own life that he told for years that wasn't true, he wanted to find that elsewhere.
Yeah, people can see that image, by the way, it's just extraordinary to look at. It's kind of a briquette iceberger, you refer to it as well, at RTÉ Arena if you want to see it.
It's so unappetizing and so unsettling, but yet at the same time so familiar and recognisable. Mm. And I think particularly because of finding bog butters and things like that we're often hearing about in the news, it's kind of an interesting one. But I think for him, because he was part of setting up a green party in Germany, he's very anti-fossil fuels. So there must be some sort of comment in it. There's humour in it, but I think there might be a comment on that idea of our burning of our natural resources.
And you spoke about him in terms of his assuming several identities. Mm. And another artist, that's hardly surprising, that Brian O'Doherty, again, had the great privilege of interviewing him a few years back. Brian O'Doherty is part of this exhibition as well. And I'm going to tweet 5 identities, looking very like Gabriel Byrne,
I have to say, in one of those identities.
It's essentially him in 5 different
and
costumes
guises.
Or personae. Mm.
So Marcel Duchamp is probably the more famous one for doing this, and he had a female character called Rose Selavy, but if you say Eros Selavy, Eros's life or sex.
And of course, O'Doherty had a great
Patrick Ireland.
Had a great relationship. With Duchamp himself. That was an important influence.
Yes, he did meet him, and he made that famous portrait of his heartbeat, you know, which he did various versions of. But with the personas and taking on Patrick Ireland, which O'Doherty did in 1972 as a response to the, you know, Bloody Sunday. But these ones are a lot more playful, a lot more fun. These 5 identities where he acts out, you know, different versions of himself, and as you rightly say, one that really to me as well looked like Gabriel Byrne.
It's very Gabriel Byrne, the second one across at RTÉ Arena, if you want to, tell us whether you think it looks like Gabriel Byrne as well. Dorothy Cross also features here as well, and this is a Connemara based artist, and I guess Connemara is featuring in what she has on display here at RTÉ Arena. We're going to tweet that image as well. What are we looking at?
So it's one of the other corridors. So instead of having those floating frames, in this case, it is a row of blocks of marble. And from a distance, when you first look at them, they sort of look unfinished, just rough cut. And the closer you get to them, you start to realise that there's perfectly carved feet within them. And for me, like, the first reference that kind of came to mind was the famous enslaved figures of Michelangelo that he designed for the tomb of Julius II that are unfinished. So it looks like figures that are breaking out of the marble. marble, and you can kind of see the chisel marks and things in those works, and they would be, you know, some of the best known in art history. But I think she's sort of taking it almost, you know, if we think about the way that she works in general, she kind of likes to bring together the idea of nature and humankind and one coming out of the other or one supporting the other. But there's just something so engaging about them, and Emma has that space to show them, and you can really kind of explore it.
Two general things that I wanted to ask you about the exhibition itself. I mean, there's often this argument thrown out, oh, well, Ireland never really was and isn't really... the visual culture isn't that important. We're a literary culture. We're a culture of music. Do exhibitions like this just... do they blow that whole argument out of the water?
I would hope so. And I mean, as someone who teaches on all areas of Irish art, you know, it's extraordinary often to me how little known it is and that we focus so much on the literary side, which is, of course, great. But we have an extraordinary wealth of Irish artists all the way through, particularly 20th and 21st century. And this is a really good example of just showing how diverse and how advanced it is, too. It's not just that we're always playing second fiddle to international movements. We have really...
we were part of those movements.
Yeah, and some of the trailblazers in them as well.
And the other aspect is we're only scraping the surface. Like what we've spoken about
100 artists.
Spoken about 7 or 8 artists in our conversation there. This is a big exhibition, but it's on for a long time. You don't have to take the whole thing in one visit.
No, I think that's the best way of doing it. Even if you kind of think thematically and say you're just sort of looking for even just the international artists, or you just look at the Irish artists, or you look at living artists and you maybe pick something or pick a theme as you go through, it's endlessly interesting. Every corner you go around, there's a surprise. There's something you didn't expect to see. And I think revisiting and going back again is really, really worthwhile.
Just before we finish up on this, sad news came through today that the painter Michael Caine has died on the eve of his 90th birthday. Terribly sad that it should have that kind of quality to it. I mean, his death is a sad thing at any rate. But the event is being celebrated in a number of exhibitions in Dublin. Had he just opened an exhibition in
recent days
even?
I think a day before he died, there was an exhibition in Taylor Galleries of his works on paper. Really extraordinary as well. I had a quick look at them online, and such a expressive, forceful, full of life, full of vitality series of works, and they're recently made, you know, so it's an incredible thing to see, you know, at someone's, you know, end of career, that they're still so incredibly, you know.
Well, the fact that he was exhibiting, you know, a couple of days before his death.
Yeah, exactly. There's one actually in another exhibition that's on in IMA at the moment as well, of his works. I think it might be the Ring's End Man. I think that's the one that's included in a work that's about time and uses some of the permanent collection as well. But he was an extraordinarily important artist, not just in terms of his own work, but you look at pretty much any, you know, important modern avant-garde art movement or committee or organisation, he was involved.
He was part of it.
Exactly, and so really helped move Irish art along.
If you're visiting Artists Agency, you could do worse than go around and have a look at the Michael Caine works that are in the other exhibition. But let us just remind people, thanks for telling us about the exhibition, Jess Fahey there. Artists Agency is this it's running until February 2028, so you do have plenty of time, but, you know, don't leave it. Take it in little bites and you'll get to enjoy it much better. Jess, of course, will be giving the tour of the Art of Agency at IMA, and you'll find out full information on all of that on the website, which is imma.ie. Now, when we think of Jonathan Swift, I think it's his literary prowess that springs to mind, Gulliver's Travels, and of course the deep satire that is of A Modest Proposal. He was, however, an extremely private man, and perhaps with good reason, given the social mores of the time. Around the time that Swift was Dean of St. Patrick's Cathedral, the two women with whom he was romantically involved, Stella and Vanessa, found out about each other. What a moment in time, the writer Jerry Mullins has chosen to write about Jonathan Swift, and it's a musical about this point when Swift was found out, as it were. Jonathan Swift, Savage Indignation. It'll be performed in two very interesting venues at the end of this month and in July. More of that anon, but Jerry Mullins is with me in studio now. Did you approach the writing about Jonathan Swift in the first place, Gerry, with a lot of knowledge and thinking, I'm going to focus in this moment in time? Or did you come to Swift knowing very little other than Gulliver's Travels and A Modest Proposal, like most of us?
I'd only gave a new bit, The Modest Proposal. This time last year, I knew very little about Swift. But I was presenting this kind of, we call it a chat show or a variety show near where I live in Dublin 8. We call it D8 Live. And I found myself interviewing a guy called Ed Coleman, who's the marketing guy in St. Patrick's Cathedral, which of course is Dublin 8 as well.
Yeah.
And we're talking all about St. Patrick's
Cathedral. And intimately associated with Swift.
Yeah. And afterwards he said, would you be interested in doing one of your D8 Lives for Jonathan Swift Festival? And I said, oh, that'd be fine. Yeah, where'll we do it? And he said, St. Patrick's Cathedral. I was like, Janie Mac, you know, because I'd been doing this in pubs.
Mm.
And so that was fine until November. And I lined up a few academics. That's great. Dr. Brendan Toomey, very knowledgeable, did his PhD in Swiss finances. Dr. Jim Lucy, a psychiatrist, knows all about the contribution towards St. Patrick's Mental Health Hospital. Cathy Scuffle, wonderful historian, local historian, Dublin City Council historian in residence. So I lined them all up, and then I got the choir from St. Patrick's Cathedral. So it was going to be great,
wow.
Right? But then I thought, you know, it would be really cool, because remember, Swift is buried under the floorboards in St. Patrick's Cathedral. So I thought it'd be really cool if during the show, Swift appears at the back of the hall, giving out about the noise, like coming along going, what is this racket?
Yeah.
What's going on? What's this racket? You know, and then putting me under pressure and all that sort of stuff. And so that was the idea. And I said, well, if I do that, if I hire in an actor, I'm going to have to give them a script. I can't expect them to improv.
Yeah.
So I had to start reading about Swift, and I was reading more, and it was getting better and better. And then I came across this woman, Stella, who, of course, is buried under the floorboards with them.
Mm.
I thought, okay.
For a long time, people would have presumed they were husband and wife.
Yes.
Was it 15 years between them, something like that?
That's correct. But they are together for 30 years of their lives. I mean, together as best pals, we can only assume that there might have been a romantic involvement. And so anyway, I had to write in the character Stella. That's two actors, two characters. And then I started to come across, they'd written lovely poems for each other. And there was a lovely beat to them. Both of them had the same beat, kind of iambic pentameter thing. And next thing, I had a song, a duet between the two of them. So that was fine, right? But then I read on a bit more. And next thing, there's another woman in the mix called Vanessa. And before long, there's these letters going between Swift and Vanessa.
So explain who Vanessa is or was.
Vanessa's his lady on the side, right? Who's even younger again. And Swift had been working in Ireland. Swift was born in Ireland, and he'd been back and forth to London. And next thing, around 1710, he got a job with the British government as a spin doctor over in the London government, really, the British, you know.
The Tory government of the day.
Yes. Yeah. And he worked there for about 3 or 4 years, 1710 to 1713, 1714. And he was a big deal. He was the Alistair Campbell type of guy. So during those 3 or 4 years, he was a very important person, and he was writing back home to Stella all the time. And that journal to Stella was published later on, and it's a great historical record of the government. But while he was over there, he met this other lady. Her real name is Esther Van Humrig. And he was so secretive. Everything he did was kind of clouded in secrecy. And he invented a name for her in his letters later on. So he took the Van from Van Humrig and Essa from her first name, Esther.
Yeah.
And he came up with the name Vanessa. So if ever you meet a Vanessa, which is a lovely name, I like the name Vanessa a lot. The first ever Vanessa was the lady we're talking about tonight. Jonathan Swift made up that name.
He made up the name?
Yes.
Or at least he used that name using parts of her.
Parts of her name
in the midst of it all.
So he has a bit of a fling with Vanessa out in London. Then the Tory government falls. He's kicked out of England, really. I mean, he wanted to become a bishop in England, but they said, look, you're too much trouble. We're going to give you the job of Dean of St. Patrick's in Dublin. And he went, oh, for heaven's sake, I don't want that job. And they said, look, it's the best you're going to get. And he said, grand, or take it. So next thing, he's back in Dublin, back with Esther Johnson, his other lady, who he had nicknamed Stella. Mm. So that's how he ended up with Stella and Vanessa, neither of whom actually existed. They both had.
But interesting that within those very private personal relationships, they weren't real names that he used.
Well, he wrote his letters to Stella and Vanessa, but if they had birth certs, there's no sign of Stella.
So anybody who was looking at those, who might have come across those letters, wouldn't necessarily know that it was the particular women that were in his life.
And he signed his letters CAD, which was short for Cadenus, which is Latin for deaconess, which is short for dean, which is the job he had. So sometimes he had these kind of little word plays.
Mm. Well, so, given the story that you're telling about the two women in his life, never was Cad a more suitable name for what he was up to.
Yeah.
So at what point do Vanessa and Stella become aware of each other's existence?
Well,
was Vanessa aware all along of Stella's existence?
Well, you see, he was denying stuff. I mean, like any guy who's having an affair, sure, the first thing you do is deny it, isn't it?
I have no idea.
And then you move to the other lies, right? So it was all fine. He was in England and the two women were at the IRC apart, right? And whatever lies
so he could have, he could live his double life.
Yes. But then Vanessa arrives over to Dublin and that's when it all gets very, very difficult. And Dublin was a very, very small town at the time. So it's hard to believe that they didn't know about each other. But there's no record of them knowing about each other until the very, very end when eventually... Because Vanessa couldn't understand why... Swift wasn't married.
Yeah.
And... she couldn't understand why he didn't marry her because he'd spoken about marriage and all that sort of stuff.
And she came to Ireland to be here and was now available to him should he choose to marry her.
Should he choose. Now, she was living at the time down in Selbridge,
which is where you would be performing it, which adds a whole new layer of meaning to it.
Yes. So she's down in Selbridge Abbey, a beautiful house on the River Liffey. You know, she's from a rich family. Her dad actually was Lord Mayor of Dublin. And he was kind of off on his horse every now and again down the Liffey for about 10 miles to get to Selbridge. And then... back home again. I don't know what he told Esther, Stella, maybe off to see some pastor in Selbridge. And I think he kept that going for a while. I did come across a beautiful poem by Stella called Jealousy. I love you, you played the monarch's part, you conquered me and then you couldn't defend my heart. It's a beautiful, beautiful poem, which is really about a woman who's been betrayed in love. So,
how angry is she in that? Because Savage Indignation is what the Jonathan Swift's Savage Indignation is, is the title of the piece. How angry is Vanessa when she finds out all of this? And, you know, does she confront him and does she confront Stella?
Well, we have Vanessa's letters and she will...
And you're using those words?
Yes, in the songs. I've written a couple of duets between Vanessa and Swift and she would tear you apart. Her writing style is amazing. Mm. She would rip you apart in a letter as she ripped apart Swift.
So why go making up that yourself? You can use her words.
Yes, yeah. And she had to have understood there's something going on because Dublin was a small town and they had friends in common. But I think he just kept denying, saying, she's just my friend, she's just my friend, you know.
But don't be fooled by, we're dealing with the 18th century and of course we all think that sex was invented in 1960, but it did exist before that.
Right.
Swift and Vanessa in particular, it's very clear in some of their correspondence that they're not really talking about what they write down on the page.
Well, this is it. You see, we're back to the code again. Her name was a code. His name was a code. And then there was this. There was always these references to coffee. Your coffee is the best. I haven't had any coffee since I last saw you. There's nothing I wouldn't like more now to walk around your garden 40 times and then drink your coffee, right? So there's all these references to coffee were a bit out of thing. And so one can only assume that coffee meant...
something else.
Right. I'm afraid to use the word. I might get wrapped. But that's the only other conclusion I can come to.
Yeah.
And then there was another, you find it in a lot of letters, that you just see dash, dash, dash. Instead of saying, she'd have to fill in the gaps herself, you know? I would love to see you again and then... dash, dash, dash.
So, and you've worked this into some of the songs.
Yeah, so one of the songs is called Dash, Dash, Dash. Just say what you want to say, dash, dash, dash.
The lyrics of the songs, to a large extent, the words that the actors are speaking, I think, is it David McLaughlin as Swift, Aisling Coleman as Stella, and Debbie Barry as Vanessa.
Yeah.
They're more or less, yes, some of it is yours and the working it into a story is yours, but they're more or less the words of Stella, Vanessa and Swift. What about the music itself? Where did that come from?
I made up the tunes, but I by accident I came across this guy called David Munro, who to me had been the father of one of the girls I was coaching in Larkview Football Club. And I knew he was good on the piano and I needed someone to put the songs down on paper. I didn't know how good. He turns out to be one of Ireland's top composers and arrangers. And on top of that, he's very generous with his time and patience with a muggins like me. And all last summer, I just set up in his studio and I would hum these tunes and he would kind of go, OK, we'll go with a D there. We'll go with D, D. Would you like a D? No, D minor, D minor. And I'd be like, oh, major, you know.
Yeah.
And he would have these sweeping, beautiful accompaniments to what were kind of humble songs. And now they're really... if I don't mind me, they're wonderful. They're wonderful songs.
It sounds like it's a lot of fun. And coffee can be had before, after, and during the performances, perhaps. I'm not sure.
And then a little bit of dash, dash, dash.
And a little bit of dash, dash on the way home. Jerry Mullins, thanks for coming into us.
We're playing Selbridge.
Yeah, I'm going to give those details now. Jerry's musical, Jonathan Swift's Savage Indignation, is part of the Swift and Vanessa Festival in Selbridge in Kildare. That's at 8 p.m. on May the 31st. And what a potent venue that is in the case of Vanessa. More information, swiftandvanessa.com. And the show will then be at the wonderful venue that is The Lark in Balbriggan in County Dublin. That's on July the 5th. And you can find out full details there on thelark.ie. But that is our lot for this Tuesday evening. I thought it was Friday, but no, it's only Tuesday. James Feeney was on sound this evening. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Research was by Liam Murphy. And tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. Back with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, here on RT Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news, which is coming up right now at 8 o'clock.